What was the songwriting process for, like, for this new record, Trinity? Give me some background information on the record, like.
Well, basically, as with all three Eden's Curse albums, the songwriting usually starts from myself. I would say all of the tracks are Saints of Tomorrow and one other track. The music all starts with the music first of all. And then I'll develop a kind of demo with a kind of lyrical concept and story and melodies. So I present basically to the band. I'll give them a zip file full of 11 completed songs, and then we'll start working individually on tracks at a time. And I write quite heavily with the drummer of the band. He's very good at hooks and melodies and choruses. We'll maybe shape some things up. Or Thorsten doesn't write an awful lot of the guitar player, but he wrote Saints of Tomorrow with the drummer Pete, and we co-wrote a tune I think which was one of the bonus tracks. So that's usually what happens, and then the final stage of the process is Michael and myself will start working through the lyrics and tightening up on some of the melodies to the songs and some of the words that he wants to sing, and make sure he's got a lot of room to breathe while he's singing, otherwise he'll pass out. And that's it. We then finish the demos off, let everybody hear them, and once we get all the kind of thumbs up from everybody, we'll actually start going into the studio and recording them.
Compared to the first album, where do you feel your songwriting relationship is at with Ann Michael?
I think third album in now. I mean, you're so used to each other in terms of the way that you work. I mean, I think Michael's really kind in the fact that he recognises that a lot of the ideas and the melodies that I work on seem to be quite strong. And I kind of try to leave a lot of, I mean, I'm not a singer at all by any means, but I try to leave as much room for interpretation for him, as every other instrument in the band. So I try to give them enough room to stamp their own authority on it. And if you were to hear, Anthony, the original demos that I send out compared to the final thing, it really is night and day. So I guess when we started working on the first record, it takes a little bit of getting used to it. And I'm not a kind of guy who's going to just, you know, I'm not an authoritarian that says, it's my way or the highway. We do work through a few things and might have the odd disagreement here and there, but I think that's normal for any band. So at this stage of we're in a career now, we totally know what each other's strengths are, and we work through the best that we can with those.
How would you describe the band's relationship with Dennis Ward, who's produced all three records?
Our relationship with him is exceptional. He's not only the band's producer, he's actually a very good friend of the band, and particularly myself, who deals with him probably a lot on a day-to-day or an album-by-album basis, I should say, instead of a day-to-day. But I keep in touch with Dennis very regularly, at least once every 2 weeks, if not once every month, and we get on personally on very, very well. And I know Pete, the drummer, who's also got a couple of other projects, has worked with him a couple of times. So we kind of see him, somebody said to me the other night in an interview that he's like the sixth member of the band. And I would actually say that Carsten Schulz of Evidence One would be our sixth member of the band. And Dennis is probably the seventh. So he contributes so much to the final outcome, the way that we sound. And he doesn't really get involved overly in terms of the songs, and he will put his two cents in if he feels something isn't working or we could be better with it. But this album, I think, was the first one he really sat back and said, wow, this is a really strong collection of songs, and I don't think it was an awful lot that he put into the table to be changed, which told us that we are developing as writers as well.
Would you say then that he's the band's Martin Birch, type of thing?
Yeah, I would guess so. I think part of it comes down to that I personally listen to. He's up there amongst the very best, if not up there, you know, within the top kind of four or five. And you've got to be realistic. None of us can, you know, have the money to go and pay for, you know, Mutt Lange at this stage in our career. But Dennis Ward delivers every time. And when you have that kind of, you know, you know exactly what you're going to get when you pass it over to Dennis, and you don't even need to worry about it. So I'm very much of the thinking that, you know, don't mess with a winning formula, and he's certainly here to stay until he either tells us he no longer wants to work with us.
I think the band would probably pull their hair out if they were working with Mutt Lange or something, because he seems...
We may do. I mean, the only thing I would insist with Mutt Lange is that he gets his ex-wife to come round for at least a visit. It's just got to be done, isn't it? Make sure we're there when she's picking the kids up or his daycare or whatever.
Yeah, definitely. What about Alessandro, the band's new keyboardist? How did he come on board?
Well, basically, we did our tour with Stratovarius back in May, and you know, because we've kind of been a band with, you know, many people had us classed as a project to start out with, which was never our plan. You know, I think when Mike and I were first, we were only two on the scene, we thought, okay, this will be a project, and we'll try and pull in the odd guitar player here and there. But it quickly developed into a fully fledged band where the guys, you know, Thorsten and Pete, were on board for the foreseeable future. So we always had the plan to go out on the road, and of course that brings with it the downside of things, where we didn't really get to know each other extremely well. We'd only met for tours, etc. So when we'd only met for photo shoots and things like that. So by the time we actually got the band together, you know, we discovered that we did have a problem with Ferdy, the old keyboard player, and you know, no doubt in his musical ability, the guy's supreme keyboard player and performer, but he just didn't click on a personal level, and his kind of personality was an issue, and we found the band was much happier when he wasn't around, so we had to address that side of it, and you know, effectively we kind of fired him after the tour. So for us it was a case of trying to find somebody who was as talented a player as Ferdy, and I don't think that was going to be an easy task. But Alessandro, I'd known about him for quite some time, and had actually co-written a song with him for a project with someone else. So just that mutual friend that we'd written for had recommended to me that we audition him, and we auditioned three keyboard players in total, and I had given everybody a copy of Angels and Demons minus the keyboards on it, and I wanted them to give me back a replication so I could hear what they would do live. And I also gave them an unfinished Eden's Curse song from Trinity that we were working on, and it had a whole missing section on it, and I wanted to see what they could actually write and bring to the table. And Alessandro's audition just blew me out of the water. That song, actually, worth pointing out, actually became No Holy Man. So he wrote the whole kind of orchestrated section where James LeBrie sings above, and then I'd given him some lyrics, and he went away, and not a lot of people know this, but Alessandro's actually a qualified vocal coach, so the guy's got a phenomenal voice, and he came back singing the lead vocals for that whole section, and that's where we decided to bring in somebody else to kind of duet on it as such. So we were delighted with his audition, and we toured for the first time while we played at Bloodstock with him, and then we did a tour in December with Aylstorm, and I don't think the band has sounded any better. You know, I think the sound is really phenomenal at the moment with him.
What was it about Ferdy then that didn't click then? How did he rub up the band the wrong way?
I don't really want to go into all the kind of details of it. I mean, I've got a lot of respect for him as a musician, and you know, as a person, he's just a nice. He is a nice guy. But you know, you want five functioning cogs within the band that all work together to produce the kind of machine as such. And I never really felt that Ferdy was fully committed to that, you know, just small things, like if you look at his website, you know, you would struggle to find any mention that he was actually a part of the band, and I felt that he wasn't really fully behind it, whereas with other projects that he was involved with, you know, it was all singing and dancing, but he was a member of that band, and there was just a lot of things on a personal level. There was a lot of complaints all the time, and you know, that does bring the atmosphere down, and it wasn't just something that happened at the tour, it was something that was there for probably 3 years, which we just kind of took as, you know, the odd bad moment, but we realised that he maybe just wasn't happy, and we weren't happy with him in the band, so we had to do something about it.
You'd think he'd be very proud to be in a really good band like Eden's Curse, to be honest.
Well, yeah, but I think maybe part of it was that he played in Axl Rudi Pell as well, and I think maybe, you know, some of the treatment, because Axl Rudi Pell's higher up than Eden's Curse, and, you know, are probably travelling and living very well, and we never ever did it, you know, we never did it really poorly, but I think it was just different to what he was used to, and he would say one thing in public and private about, you know, I'll do this, I'll do that, and I can't wait to get in the road, but when we actually got there, it was almost the complete opposite, so you've got to practice what you teach in my book, to be honest.
Yeah, definitely. Sounds like he was, well, this is just my personal, like, from what you're telling me, so obviously you're not saying this, but sounds like he thought, well, because he was, like, had played in, like, Axl Rudi Pell, and I thought he was, like Eden's Curse was a bit beneath him type of thing. I don't know. That's the way it comes across. Is it possible that, in, like, you mentioned about Alessandro's vocal abilities, no, bear in mind, I've never heard him sing, but is it possible on future you might take the lead on one or two tracks or something?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we've only got one singer in the band, and that would leave him without very much to do. So, no, Alessandro was brought in basically. I mean, there's no doubt that he was brought in to replace Ferdy, but his vocal abilities are certainly something that we looked at, because I think the other kind of keyboard players, in fact, the other two were British based, which we were definitely trying to do, because we base ourselves in the UK for when it comes to touring, so a British-based player made a lot of sense to us, but at the end of the day, it came down to raw talent, and whereas the travel expenses from Italy were certainly going to be a little bit higher, the talent was far supreme to the other guys, far superior, beg your pardon. But his vocal ability too, I mean, we've got such huge choirs on our album, to kind of replicate them live is really quite a piece of work, so when you're adding a voice of the calibre of Ali's into the mix, it's only going to make the band sound a lot better, so that was something we decided in the end, that for the live sound we would have to do, and he sings Pamela Moore's parts on Angels and Demons live, and he also will probably, no doubt, do James Labrie's parts, and I don't know if he'll quite do Andy Derris's, I'm not quite sure, but you know, he will get his point at that case to showcase his vocal abilities.
Okay. How would you compare this record then to the previous two records?
It's a good question. Well, I think the first one was obviously just a case of us, you know, establishing ourselves on the scene and, you know, finding our way. I think the second one took that to another level, where our songwriting kind of developed a little bit and probably matured a little bit, and we maybe tried a couple of things that, you know, maybe a song like Sail On, that we had nothing like that on the first album, and found it a real success for us. So I like to think that there was a progression between the first and the second, and I definitely feel that we've taken another progression on Trinity, because we are a live band now as well, and that definitely played a part in it, where we tried to think like a live band, whereas the first two records we'd never ever played live, so the small notes, like a lot of the songs in the second coming in the first record would fade out. Whereas on Trinity, a lot of the endings are actually worked out for us so that we can play them exactly as we recorded them. So we've taken that on, and we've definitely worked very, very hard on the lyrical content of the new record. That's definitely something we've worked on, and just trying to reproduce the standard of songs that we've written before without repeating ourselves. So I would say it's an extension of The Second Coming, but even with a little bit extra into it, there's maybe a few heavier elements, there's a couple of maybe even more kind of contemporary elements if you listen to something like Saints of Tomorrow, and maybe even a little bit of pop if you listen to a kind of style that we adopt from the ballad. It's a little bit different to what we've done before, but essentially it's Eden's Curse.
Okay, where does Michael come from with the lyrics then on this record? I'm assuming he wrote the lyrics.
No, he doesn't really write lyrics. I write most.
Oh, you do the lyrics as well, okay.
Well, yeah, I do everything. So,
where are you coming from with the lyrics then, Paul?
I just come from social commentaries. I come from, you know, maybe inspiration from movies, like Jerusalem Sleeps was based upon the movie Kingdom of Heaven. Just the whole kind of fight between the Christians and the Muslims over Jerusalem. So it was something that I wanted to write about. So I take inspiration from all walks of life, and you know, I like to have a little bit of thought provocation involved in it. You know, if you think of Trinity, the song itself, it's just a song basically that's looking at how some people can lead their lives and do one thing, and you know, the whole kind of Trinity Sanctus Central gives you a little bit of an insight into that. You've got the hitman who's collecting his money from a senator for doing some kind of dirty deed, and then walks into a church with his family. So that song just questions how some people act, whether it's in politics, whether it's in business, whether it's in just day-to-day life, and it kind of talks about how we all kind of live under the same sun, and at the end of the day we'll all be judged the same way. So if you're going to choose a path in life, choose it wisely.
How did James LeBrie of Dream Theater come to guest on No Holy Man?
With lots of begging and a large bag of cash.
Seriously? Seriously?
We always have guests on our records, the first two certainly, and it was something that we wanted to do again. It's actually, for us as artists, it's actually great fun. It's a phenomenal promotional tool for us too, because we can open the band's name to some different fans of the band that we think might like our music. So it's kind of a cool thing to do, but predominantly it's a fanboy moment for us. Mike and I are huge, as most of the guys are in the band, we're huge supporters of kind of hard rock, melodic metal. So we get to play a little bit like the kiddie in the sweetie shop, and we don't always get who we go for, you know. We have contacted a lot of singers in the past, but we try and pull together with each album a little list, and again, that was no different this time around. And James was one of the names on that list that we contacted, and contacting these guys is probably the hardest part about it, and the hardest part is convincing them that they're a good enough band for them to appeal. So it was a simple case of trying to track James down. We managed to do that. We managed to speak to him, and we sent him the stuff, and he just absolutely loved it. So the unfortunate thing for us, the timing of me talking to him, he was just about to head out to Argentina and Brazil, Latin America with Dream Theater, and he'd asked that we upload the first two records, which we did, and he took them away on the laptop. And lo and behold, I started getting a couple of messages from him saying he'd been listening to it on the bus, on the iTunes, and just absolutely loved the first two records, and inquired would the second one be in the same vein, and we said yeah, pretty much so, and gave him a couple of demos, which he loved, and we gave him Holy Man, the demo, and we really wanted him to sing some lead on it, and just really piqued his interest. So he told us he would be back in Canada in a couple of weeks' time, and we were to give him a call. So Mike and I got on a kind of conference call with him, I think for about 2 hours solid. It was great. We just got to chat away to him, and he asked us lots of questions about the band, and we just chatted about music in general, and just kind of just like you would do in the pub with your mates. It was just, except it was over a telephone, and it was just a case for him, Anthony, just to sound us out and find out how we were as blokes. He'd, unbeknown to us at the time, he'd pretty much made his mind up on, he loved the music, he would really love to sing on the record, and it was just a case of finding out if, what kind of people we were we cool, did we have integrity, etc. And just at the very end of the call, he just said to us, right guys, I've decided I'm going to sing on it. You know, he says, I've done this a couple of times with bands before, and you might not get past first base if I don't like the music. He says, but then I always follow up with a telephone call, and he says, I'll be honest with you, I have spoke to a couple of bands and thought, nah, they're a couple of dicks, and he hasn't followed up the interest. And so we were delighted when he said that, and it was just a case of working out financially what the deal was going to be, and we got it all sorted. So James is still very much in the band's corner, and helping promote the video, and agreeing to have his character appear on the video too, and we talk to him every kind of couple of weeks, so delighted about it.
When you contact these guests then, have you got to approach them like with a financial offer then, or is it more...
Usually not at that point, definitely at some point in the proceedings, yes, money will come into it. I mean, it's very, very, very rare that you find somebody who's going to give up their time, particularly if you're looking for, you know, somebody who's of very, very high calibre. And we have got a couple of people who we work with who have donated their time for nothing, and they refuse to take payment whenever we go back to them. So, you know, guys like Doogie White, Doogie's a great friend of the band, and, you know, refuses to take payment for singing on the record. And unfortunately, due to scheduling issues, we couldn't get him on Trinity, but he was absolutely up for it, and just will not take payment because it's a friendship thing. So, yeah, it comes into play, sadly, at times, but, you know, if we feel somebody's worth it and they're of a high quality and will bring something to the table, then it's certainly something that we do and have done and probably will continue to do.
But with the financial payment, it's not, they don't like demand taking the piss type amounts, do they, or anything?
No, I mean, you know, we've obviously got our budget for the record, and we've obviously got an idea of what we will spend, and in the cases of some people, we've all go the extra mile, and guys like James LeBee, that's no doubt about it, because they can bring so much more to the table. But like, I mean, we have spoken to one or two people who have an inflated sense of their own, you know, worth, and that just doesn't go past second base. So the first thing is find out if the interest there, second find out what it will take financially, and see if we can agree a deal. So we haven't paid silly amounts yet, but I don't think we'd probably afford it, to be honest.
Who have you approached in the past then that haven't agreed, or you can't disclose at all?
No, I'd rather not say. I'd rather talk about the guys that have.
Have you got like a dream list then, or anything like that?
Do I have a dream list?
Like a couple of guys who you would really like to guest in future stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I would really like to do some work with Toby Sammet. I think that would be something. I'm a massive fan of him and Ed Dye, and would love to try and get him to do something at some point in the future. And I mean, I'd love to do something with, you know, maybe somebody like Bruce Dickinson. You know, I grew up with Maiden as a young boy. So we, as I said, you know, we do get to play tints in the sweetie shop, but getting to these people and being able to agree deals with them, etc., is a difficult part. So, but yeah, that's a couple I would love to do some stuff with.
Okay, because with Tobias, it could very much be he might ask you to appear on something, because he seems to have a lot of guests on his stuff with Avantasia and that.
Yeah, Yeah, well, that would be cool, you know, that would be brilliant. I wouldn't even hesitate at that, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of guests, what about Andy Derris on Black Widow?
Yeah, Andy was the complete opposite of James. I've got my own kind of web company, and we do a lot of work for rock bands, etc. And we were working on a site for Unisonic, which is this new project with Michael Kiske, Dennis Ward from Pink Cream, Foster Zafuri from Pink Cream, and I think it was Mandy Meyer that used to play with Focus and Gotthard. So when I'd done the work for Unisonic, Costa, who is also, he's not only the drummer in Pink Team 69, but he's also the tour manager of Helloween, so he'd said to me, if you ever need a hand with anything, just give me a shout. So I kind of called that favour in and just said to him, would you mind asking Andy, would he be interested in singing in a song? And it was a case of uploading a song to him, letting him hear it, and I got a note. They say that's fine, Andy will do it. Sent the stuff to him and got his vocals back, and that was it. I never heard a thing from Andy at all. No, didn't even get an email or nothing, just got the vocals, so that was cool.
Oh, okay. The band opted to cover Dio on the record as well.
Yep, we did that. I remember that we had just been putting the finishing touches to the drum tracks, and Mike had called from the States quite upset that Ronnie had passed on, and Mike's an old acquaintance of Ronnie's, known Ronnie for years, so and just simply adored the man, you know, he did very well with the man every time he met him, and he just asked would we have time to squeeze in one more song, and we just agreed it with Pete that while we were finishing the tracks, we would put in a Dio cover. So it was just simply a case of finding out what the actual song was that we were going to choose, and we decided to go for Rock and Roll Children because it wasn't as obvious as the others, and obviously it had a lot of keyboards in it, which suited our style of music. So Pete had to quickly kind of learn the drum track. Us guys did it a little bit easier because we could take a couple of weeks learn it, and it turned out great. We're really happy with it, and we just hope that wherever Ronnie is, he would approve, and it's just a way of paying tribute to him and what he meant to all of our lives.
Yeah, I mean, I interviewed him about October 2009, about a month, he was about to come over for a European tour, and then a month later it came out and he was ill. And I thought, when I interviewed him, I thought, oh, it's going to be some great music from more, like, he'd done great music, but even more great music, but even though he was that old, I mean, he was still doing great music, you know?
Yeah.
It's a shame, really.
Yeah, he was a legend. I mean, I think, I'll never forget a comment that Dougie White told me. I mean, he was, he's good pals with Rudy Sarzo, and, you know, they didn't even know that Ronnie was ill and found out secondhand, and the comment that they guys came out with was, he's the Elvis of our generation, you know, and when you think about it, he really is. Really is.
Yeah, definitely. How much of an influence was Ronnie then on Eden's Curse? Or is, rather?
Yeah, I think you can actually hear it in some of the guitar passages. Definitely, you know, the kind of, if you even just listen to No Holy Man, the kind of Holy Diver groove to it. So, I mean, that kind of hard rock is definitely the kind of school of thought that we come from, and you know, you try not to rip people off, but you pick up little bits over the years that you think just the writing style that they've got. And I mean, I think Ronnie was one of the best lyricists around, you know, very, very underrated lyricist, and if you could be as good as he was, you know, even 2% as good as he was, you would be delighted. So influenced in then many different ways, and one of the things that definitely was an influence was the way he treated people. I think I've never ever had the fortune to actually meet him, but from everybody that I've ever read a comment or heard that he's met Ronnie James Dio, they all talk about the way he treated people, and I think that's something that you would like to take as an artist, that when you meet your fans, that you hope that they come away thinking that you're a good person, because you really appreciate meeting them face to face, and you know, I find it quite a humbling thing that when somebody tells me that my songs mean so much to them. So that's definitely something I've tried to take as an influence from them.
It's funny you mention his lyrics, because when you said that, I was just thinking, new record, Angels and Demons, and obviously one of the tracks Ronnie's known for is Heaven and Hell, so
yeah.
Bit of a similar title going on here.
Similar, you know, probably more influenced by Dan Brown, that one, than anything, but I like the kind of, a lot of people assume that Eden's Curse, particularly on Trinity, we've been asked if it's a concept album, we've been asked if we're a Christian band.
God.
Honest, I mean, nobody ever asked if Dio were a Christian band or anything. I just think there's a great kind of mysticism around the whole kind of theological kind of song structures and lyrics, and I think it ties in nicely with the band's name, Eden's Curse. You know, even pondering the question, what is Eden's Curse? And we've always tried to put a little bit of thought into our music, and even our album covers, that they all have a little message. The name of the band has a little message that makes hopefully people think, and that's what we like to do. You know, you take whatever you want out of it, if it's good, if it's bad, if you're offended or not. We don't set out to offend anybody at all. We're not here to preach to anybody. It's just a little bit of thought provocation, because, you know, in this genre particularly, I think it's too easy to go down the route of boy meets girl and wants to shag girl, and many times have you heard it, and it's still carrying on to this day.
Too many times.
yeah, come on, we've all got a brain in our head. We can rise above that and do something else, you know.
Just curious, is there a period of Ronnie James Dio's you prefer, like certain band or anything like that he was part of?
Well, for me, I'd say Holy Diver, definitely. That's just an absolute classic. You know, I think when they had Vivian, and poor Ronnie would be spitting in his grave when the mere mention of that name. But you know, I think that was the era for me that just had everything.
Okay, because I prefer stuff with Rainbow,
I don't know if it's my age, but I kind of missed the whole Rainbow thing and more kind of took into Dio, to be honest. So, but yeah, I've went back to it and like a lot of it, there's no doubt, like a lot of it. But I definitely, Dio was much more my thing.
How old are you, out of curiosity, then, Paul?
35.
Alright, I'll be 24 this year, so...
Right.
So I think he appeals to all ages, really, Ronnie.
He does. I mean, depends if you're growing up with older brothers and sisters, and if parents listen to it and pass it on, depending how you can get a hold of it, and you know, with a lot of music, you've probably done it yourself. You listen to a band, you think, bloody hell, they're cool. You find out they were in a previous band, and you go and check that out too. So a lot of people do that and take their things, and I think probably now that Eden's Curse has always been linked to pretty closely to Rainbow in terms of sound, with the Hammond organs and some of the approaches and songs. I've gone and kind of checked a lot of their stuff out too, so yeah, I kind of certainly know a lot more about them and appreciate them a lot more nowadays.
Where do you feel the band will go from here then, Paul?
Well, good question. I think... I really can't answer that question, to be honest. Honestly, I mean, I think I know where I would like to take it, but you know, you just have to. I think everything kind of rests in the lap of the gods in this business, and it's you know, I think with any business it's probably the same, but more so with this, because you lay your soul bare on the line, and it's open to criticism, and that's a hard thing. You've got to take everything with a pinch of salt, and don't read too much into the good reviews, and that way you'll not read too much into the bad ones either. So you've got to heed your own counsel and be very, very sure of where you want it to go yourself, and just try your damnedest to get there. So I don't know. I mean, I would like us to do a lot more in the live scene, and I know that we probably hinder ourselves because of our international setup, because it means that we've got quite large travelling expenses, and we're at that point in our career now where we've sold quite a few records, we've played a couple of successful tours, that we just won't go and play for anything now. It's got to be financially viable for us, because we can't continue to keep losing money. So I'm just hoping that the involvement of people like Andy and particularly James, I mean, we've already seen what we are calling the Labrie effect in the band at the moment. Just looking at the launch of the video last week, we've done 14,000 plays as of tonight in I think 4 days. And to compare that to the last video for Angels and Demons did 22,000 in 2.5 years. So there's a definite interest in the band just now, there's a definite upturn in interest, and I hope that carries on. You know, we would love to go out, I mean, for example, with a band like Dream Theatre, it would be perfect for us to be opened up to a bigger, wider audience that probably haven't heard the band, and we've seen it with our own two eyes when we've got in front of audiences, our songs are strong enough and we're a decent enough live band that we can convert people. We did it at Stratovarius, we did it at Aelstorm, and if we can just keep doing that, then we might just break through.
Would you say then a realistic goal for the band is to be able to do this? It obviously would have to be financially viable, but doing this as a full-time occupation?
That would be a dream come true. I'm not quite sure, and I hate to sound like the guy with a half glass half empty, because that's so not me. I'm quite a positive person, but at this stage you can't foresee where your breakthrough is going to come. I mean, if it is with somebody like Dream Theater going out on tour with them or something, which is, I mean, it isn't even a possibility at this stage, so I'm just using that as an example. It could be for Maiden or something like that. Then that would be a big chance. I don't think there's going to be I don't think there's going to be a hit single on the radio or anything like that. But I would think it would have to be quite a lot to allow us to do it full time. You know, if we can do it part time and have the band generating enough income that we can afford to do it and do that quite regularly, then I would be quite happy with that.
Problem the band got really is it's great music, but is it? I don't want this to come across the wrong way, but it's sort of the band's, if this was music coming out in the 80s, then you'd be selling millions of records, you know?
Well, I think that's the same for a lot of bands. I mean, if you look at Whitesnake, if you look at Ozzy, if you look at any of these bands, I mean, if you put them up next to us, there really isn't much that separates them in terms of style. The only difference that separates them is budgets and the name and the achievements that they've made themselves. So I think this music, time and time again, has shown if there's money behind it to promote it extremely well, and that doesn't mean just sticking the record in the shops. It means getting the band out. I mean, you know, if I'd have brought Airborne to you 10 years ago, you'd have told me I was smoking crack, that they would be one of the biggest bands in Great Britain, because you would look at it and say, don't they just sound like AC/DC? You know, so if they can be promoted to an extremely high level and be selling extremely well, then anybody can do it. And they are a good band. I don't mean that to come out the wrong way. I don't mean to knock that they're a band or anything. They're not. I'm just meaning that their general sound, etc., is nothing different.